This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
From the unexplained to the mundane, come join us on a journey to the fringe. Hello and welcome to Journey to the Fringe, giving you the background on weird things people don't talk about much. We are your podcast hosts, Taylor and Chelsea, here today doing a look into, Chelsea, I don't want to say asshole of the UFO community, because I don't know at this point if I would consider this an asshole of the UFO community, but it's a person in the UFO community. That is one astronaut by the name of Edgar Mitchell.
Okay.
Now, this is going to be a two-part episode. The first part, we're going to look at his career before getting into UFOs. And then the next episode is going to be from that point onwards. Chelsea, how familiar are you with Edgar Mitchell?
Only kind of, sort of. I don't know a whole lot about him. I'm sure in all my years of listening to things that I've listened to things about him.
Well, you've probably heard him too, in fact.
I'm pretty sure I have, but there's nothing that I can actually fully recall of him saying. But I do know of him. I know he's an astronaut that talks about UFOs, but I can't quote anything that he's been saying.
I think he's come up like four or five times in episodes for us, but it's always just like passing remarks. And he's used as a buttress, a support for your position to like say like, look, even this astronaut believes it. So surely
I was gonna say that
makes sense.
Yeah, I was gonna say that too. I'm sure there's a lot of assholes in the UFO community even using him to reference stuff that they're talking about. I'm sure of they're an astronaut.
And in fact, the most recent episode I think he came up in was the Stephen Greer episodes where he had to come out and condemn what Stephen Greer was saying about him.
Right. Yes. Yes, I remember that now. Good old Stephen Greer.
Yeah.
I hate him.
Oh god, he's an awful human being.
Such an asshole.
But because he does come up in passing in that way, and he's used to support, and it's basically like saying, like, if this astronaut can believe these things, then surely there's implications for it. He learned these things while he was doing that. What he did in space supports what I'm talking about. Something along those lines has to be there.
Even if you say this astronaut believes in UFOs, I mean, there's a couple of them that believe in UFOs. Even if you put that out, like, this astronaut believes in UFOs, there's a little bit of credence to that for the mere fact that they've stepped foot in space.
Exactly. No, there's implications that it has something to do with their career, is there not?
There is, yeah, because they've been in space, so they too are an alien.
Okay.
They know about
not quite what I was going to do. I was going to say that they saw something while they were in space, or something connected them to it.
Both those things can be right.
My personal theory, which we'll likely talk about more later, because astronauts are kind of like professional athletes in that their actual career ends fairly early on that end, they end up retiring early and getting a lot of time for hobbies. But let's not lead that away from what we're going to be talking about.
Let's talk about what you're talking about then.
Let's talk about Edgar Mitchell.
Let's
I do have to spoil this now. Edgar, unfortunately, is dead. I believe he died in 2016. He lived a long, happy life, though, so don't worry too much about that. Edgar Mitchell was born on September 17th, 1930, Hereford, Texas. He came from a ranching family that moved him to New Mexico during the Depression and considered Artesia, New Mexico, which is near Roswell, his hometown. He first learned to fly, and this is very much so something that can't happen in these generations anymore, when he was 13. It's just not something that's an opportunity for everybody anymore. He received his first private pilot license at 16, was active in the Boy Scouts of America, where he achieved its second highest rank, Life Scout. So you know he's not a liar.
Yeah. But it also makes me concerned for his safety, because a lot of controversies probably going around back then in the Boy Scouts.
Well, no, they weren't out yet. He was also a member of the... This is... I was thinking of cutting this out, but just because of the implications of it in the conspiracy community, had to keep it in. He was a member of the Demolay International, part of the Masonic fraternity, and was inducted into its Hall of Fame. Mitchell was a member of Artesia Lodge number 29 in New Mexico. He received a Bachelor of Science degree in the Industrial Management from Carnegie Institute of Technology in 1952, where he was a member of Kappa Sigma fraternity. The same year, he entered the United States Navy and completed basic training at San Diego Recruit Depot. While on active duty in the Navy, he earned a second bachelor's degree in aeronautical engineering from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in 1961 and a doctorate of science degree in aeronautics and astronautics from MIT in 1964. I wouldn't normally get too much into the personal life, but this weirdly comes up in the second half.
Okay, I'll try my best.
He's had multiple marriages. First, married to Louise Randall from 1951 to 1972. They get divorced. He marries Anita Redig in 1973. And then they get divorced in 84. And he ends up having an affair and marrying a Playboy model, Sheila Ledbetter.
Okay.
He lives a very promiscuous life, I think, to say the least there.
Yeah, no, that's the exact word I was just going to use.
When it comes to flying, he has a pretty good career. In May of 53, after completing instructing at the Officer Candidate School at Newport, Rhode Island, Mitchell was commissioned an ensign. He completed flight training in July of 1954. Following the completion of his graduate studies, Mitchell served as Chief Project Management Division of the Navy Field Office for the Manned Orbiting Laboratory from 64 to 65. From 65 to 66, he attended the U.S. Air Force Aerospace Research Pilot School for certification as a test pilot. Graduating first in his class during this period, Mitchell served as an instructor in advanced mathematics and navigation theory for astronaut candidates. Mitchell accumulated during his career 5,000 hours flight time, including 2,000 hours in jet aircrafts. And that brings us to his NASA career. Mitchell was selected in 66 as part of NASA's fifth astronaut group. He was assigned to the support group for Apollo 9 and then was designated as a backup lunar module pilot for Apollo 10. This placed him in rotation for Apollo 13, but he got switched to Apollo 14 so that Commander Alan Shepard, who had been grounded by a medical problem since the Gemini program, could train longer. During the Apollo 13 crisis, Mitchell was part of the Apollo 13 operations team and as such was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by Nixon in 1970. He worked in an Apollo simulator to help bring the crew back. One issue he worked on was how to fly the lunar module with an inert Apollo command service module attached to it. I looked it up. His name's not actually used in Apollo 13, the movie, but he's a very integral part to getting these people back to Earth, which is just crazy.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Tom Hanks back down to Earth, right?
Yeah. Tom Hanks? You got it. Yeah, Tom Hanks. I think he had a different name in the movie, but Tom Hanks.
Oh, okay.
He then went on to serve as the lunar module pilot on Apollo 14, landing with Shepard aboard the lunar module Antares on February 5th, 1971, in the hilly uplands of Fra Mauro Highlands region of the moon. They stayed on the moon for 33 hours, deployed and activated lunar surface scientific equipment and experiments, and collected over 100 pounds of lunar samples for return to Earth. Other Apollo 14 achievements include only use of the mobile equipment transporter, first successful use of the color television with a new Vidicon tube, longest distance traversed on foot on the lunar surface, largest payload placed in lunar orbit, first use of the shortened lunar orbit rendezvous technique, and first extensive orbital science period conducted during CSM solo operations. Chelsea, this one's also incredibly famous. This is the one where they went golfing on the moon.
Okay, I just had a train of thought here, and I hope I'm not ruining anything by saying this. Edgar Mitchell isn't the one who was recorded where, was it, they went around the dark side of the moon, and they lost contact, but they were recorded as doing something? Yeah. Okay, it's not Edgar Mitchell.
That's not him. I'm trying to think of who that is, but it's not him.
Yeah, it's just right on the tip of my brain. I can't remember exactly what it is, but you know
In any event, he is one of two astronauts who spent the most time on the moon. It's one of the most famous photos of astronauts on the moon that he took. He was part of the team that golfed on the moon. Fairly big deal. And in completing his first spaceflight, Mitchell logged 216 hours and 42 minutes in space. He was subsequently designated to serve as backup on the lunar module pilot for Apollo 16. During the mission, he took photos, including the one with Shepard raising the American flag. In the photo, Mitchell's shadow is cast over the lunar surface near the flag. The photo is listed in Popular Science's photo gallery as the best astronaut selfies. And a quote that he has from his time in space: "You develop an instant global consciousness, a people orientation, an intense dissatisfaction with the state of the world, and a compulsion to do something about it. From out there on the moon, international politics looks so petty. You want to grab a politician by the scruff of the neck and drag him a quarter of a million miles out and say, 'Look at that, you son of a bitch.'"
I like that.
Up to there, very impressive.
Yeah.
I texted you this, and I was trying for the longest time to figure out what was his jump from this to UFOs. Was it this, like, global encompassing idea, like there's something bigger than just us? And then I keep doing some research, and I learn more.
Okay, good. That's usually how it works.
We're going to go to a Vice article on this.
Now, can I just interrupt and ask another question?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's Buzz Aldrin. It was the first walk on the moon. That was fate. That was my whole train of thought.
Oh, yeah, where he gets confronted and punched somebody in the face. Yeah, that's not him.
No, he actually was on the moon. There's no conspiracy theories about him not being there.
Nobody seems to dispute him. And it's kind of funny because he's on the conspiracy side on a lot of these things. So they're just like, yeah, sure, he went to the moon. Why not?
Yeah, no, he actually did.
He's fine.
Good for him. Okay.
I found an article on Vice, and it's called "The Moonwalking Alien Hunting Psychic Astronaut Who Got Sued by NASA." It's by Alex Pasternak from May 14th, 2016.
I like all of that, what you just said.
Well, I think they might have put some keywords in there.
But you also started it with Vice, so I also like that.
All great stuff. "While Mitchell and crewmate Alan Shepard would have more time than anyone else to amble across the lunar surface, 9 hours, the schedule remained tight. There was important work to do in the name of politics, but also of science. On the way back to Earth, however, things were more relaxed, quieter. Mitchell took time to look out the window and was transfixed by the sight of the largest thing he'd ever seen, the largest thing he'd ever known, floating in the dark. A moment would change his life, giving him a glimpse of a deeper hidden nature. Quote, all of us had the experience, let's call it the overview effect or the big picture effect, of seeing Earth in its setting rather than as the end all and be all of living systems. End quote. Mitchell told me in 2012. Quote, my own experience was a very powerful one. On the way back, after my work was done, from looking at Earth from space, you come up with the question, who are we? How did we get here? And where is all this going? And that's an ancient, ancient question that humans have asked for a long time. My experience was to realize that perhaps our science is wrong at answering these questions, and perhaps our religious cosmologies are archaic and flawed. And given that now we are an extraterrestrial civilization, our ourselves, we need to re-ask these questions and do a lot more work to find the answers. End quote. But more so than other astronauts, Mitchell's brief trip to outer space led to a lifelong exploration of inner space and an entire universe of unexplained phenomena. Continuing an unauthorized ESP experiment he began in the command module during his trip back to Earth, Mitchell became a connoisseur of parapsychology, conferring with mystic healers and psychics like Uri Geller.
Oh no.
Later, he would examine allegations of alien visits to Earth and claim that governments around the world had sought to cover up the truth about UFOs. It just so happened that Mitchell spent much of his adolescence in Artesia near Roswell and was a teenager in July of 1947 when the famous UFO crash happened there. He had spoken with people in the government who confirmed his suspicions but confessed he had no hard proof. What evidence there was enough for him, he said. And anyway, typical scientific proof could only go so far, he seemed to argue. So much about the universe remained mysterious and deserved continuous, even highly speculative exploration. That was his major key. a theme that emerged from his return trip to Earth and the interconnected euphoria he experienced. Many, if not all, astronauts report that the global perspective changes not just physically, but psychically once they've seen Earth from space. A sublime feeling about nature and that we're just scratching the surface of it, and that most of the time it's barely seen, much less understood. Quote, there was a sense that our presence as space travelers and the existence of the universe itself was not accidental, but that there was an intelligent process at work, end quote. He wrote in his book, The Way of the Explorer. Kevin Oshner, director of the Social Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratory at Columbia University, told Motherboard's Dave Simpson that feeling seems to be something like awe, quote, a diminished sense of self in the face of something larger and bigger than you that has existed for a longer period of time than you. It's sort of incomprehensible within the lifespan of a single person, and it has interesting transformative effects on people in the short term and long term, end quote. The feeling of seeing the Earth from space might be the quintessential idea of the sublime, an idea plumbed by the Romantics. David Morris, a professor of English at the University of Illinois and a scholar of utopian 19th century literature, compares it to the experience of the whale, the idea that, quote, nature can't quite be understood or confronted, but one looks at it with awe, end quote. The next year, he and an investor, Paul Temple, co-founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Northern California. Noetic means psychic sciences, basically.
Now I remember where I know I'm from.
A nonprofit group dedicated to studying how beliefs, thoughts, and intentions affect.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
The physical world. The word noetics from the Greek, it's right here, noetikos, relates to a branch of philosophy concerned with the study of mind and intellect. Mitchell sought to usher this study into the scientific realm.
He's a part of Tom DeLonge's group, isn't he?
He's dead. He died right around the time that To the Stars came out, so I don't know if he ever was.
I want to say there was some mention of him in our episodes that we did on To the Stars. I want to say that, but I'm going to look at it while you do your talking.
Okay. The Institute's website, which received a bump in traffic after its work was featured in The Lost Symbol, a novel by Dan Brown, quotes the psychologist William James prescribing the noetic quality of mystical states, which sounds like the sort of thing Mitchell experienced in space. Quote, the states of insight into depths of truth unplumbed by the discursive intellect. They are illuminations, revelations full of significance and importance, all inarticulate, though they remain, and as a rule, they carry them with them a curious sense of authority, end quote. Bolstered by new explorations into consciousness and the quantum underpinnings of the brain, Mitchell promulgated a theory that all actions in the universe are imprinted upon a transcendent quantum hologram. The notion that the entire universe lives on a hologram has become a focus of some theoreticians, but it's not the same as quantum holography, a method in modern physics that allows researchers to image hidden objects with entangled photons. This concept he described as a giant hard disk in the sky encoding every event and object across time and space. And Chelsea, from that article, I kind of got the impression somewhat that it was seeing everything from space again brought him to this UFO and noetics. But there's one thing within that that gave the impression that it could have happened before that. It's the fact that he was carrying out a science experiment on board that got brought up with Uri Geller.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this must run deeper. This is an interview that Edgar Mitchell gave in late 2001 to a magazine called Cabinet.
Okay.
And this is him describing some of the things about this test. So let's just learn here. This is Edgar speaking. It happened about 3 weeks before the mission. I met some research physicists, Drs. Boyle and Maxey, who are very very interested in the field and suggested to me that this would be an ideal time to do the experiment. They gathered and coordinated everything. I was too busy for that. In addition to the two of them, there was a reputable psychic that they knew, and Olaf Jonsson, who was a well-known public psychic in Chicago. We practiced a few times with the principals before the flight. As far as we knew, it doesn't take any expertise at all except relaxation and focus and the ability of individuals to intuitively resonate with someone else. Next, he's answering this question, were you already interested in ESP? Answer, oh yes. I had a religious upbringing and was always interested in science. The two seemed to have different answers, which bothered me. When the chance to go to the moon came up, it re-raised the question about what kind of world we lived in, because nobody had been outside the atmosphere. I had been reading literature for several years and had become convinced science says it can't work, but laboratory experiments show that it does. Next, he's answering this question. Why the interest in doing these experiments in space? Because no one had ever done them at those distances. The question was whether the effect fell off with distance, and the answer is no. People had thought this, but no one had ever proved it at distances of hundreds of thousands of miles. Was it difficult to hide this experiment from your colleagues? There was nothing to hide. I conducted the experiment on my own time with my friends. It was really intended to be a very personal and private experiment. We had no intentions to making it public. Olaf Jonsson unfortunately told the press before we ever had a chance to look at the data. The media was a big problem because they were biased against the experiment. Most people in the media don't know anything about statistics, and they wrote whatever the particular reporter or editor thought. When the media learned about the experiment, it lost its effectiveness, even though it was subsequently published in scientific journals. Of course, one experiment doesn't make anything change, but it did show that what had worked in the laboratory also worked in space with the same very positive results. Professionals in the field thought it was very significant. In telepathy, space doesn't matter. Now we understand this very well, and we have the science now to show exactly how it works. It has nothing to do with space and time. It is what we call non-local communication. Next question, could you explain how you set up the experiment? My experiment involved four transmission sessions during rest periods programmed into the flight. The well-known experiment in the laboratory was to use cards with the five Zener symbols, but the actual cards aren't important. It was easier for me to use random number tables than carry the physical cards. Instead, all I did was generate four tables with 25 random numbers just using the numbers 1 to 5, then randomly assigned a Zener symbol to each number. For each transmission, I would then check the particular tables of random numbers and think about the corresponding symbol for 15 seconds. Each transmission was about 6 minutes. I did this when I was ready to go to sleep at night. We had sleeping bag hammocks that we would put underneath the couches, and two of us would go to sleep in a hammock while the other one would be on watch. I would do the experiment before going to sleep in my sleeping bag. So Chelsea, do you kind of understand what the experiment was?
Yeah, if he was saying that he did this on his own time and everything, and it was just his friend leaking this, how did it make it into scientific journals?
It sounds like they were trying to actually come up with a scientific paper, but it got leaked before the paper actually came out.
Oh, okay, I misunderstood that.
Yeah, I just want to make sure too, when he's talking about transmitting, he's not talking about sending like an actual communication back to Earth about his responses. He is saying, I'm thinking these thoughts out to the void so that the psychics can hear them.
Yeah, not quite the same concept of like remote viewing or ESP for that matter. He's just kind of putting it out into the universe to see who could pick it up. I'd be interested to hear his results on that.
Yes, we're going to get to that, and also okay. A few other things about it.
I've actually never heard the concept of just putting it out there while you're in space, or how you would study that. How is that in a scientific paper?
And the next question they ask is, how are you able to coordinate with the people on Earth? Answer. We didn't. We tried to coordinate, but we were off. That didn't seem to make any difference. We took off 40 minutes late, but I didn't try for any exact time anyways, just in the evenings. We now understand why that should work, because the sequence is important, but having the precise time is not. So, like, it wasn't like these guys were trying to receive what he was putting out there at the same time. It was just, they guessed, basically. They went out there and time didn't matter. They went out there and tried to get it.
This experiment seems like a mess.
You don't say. Were your colleagues at NASA suspicious when you returned? Answer, everything proceeded normally. I later became a standby pilot for Apollo 16 and retired from NASA in 72. The reaction at NASA was very, very minimal, except for Wernher von Braun and quite a few engineers. NASA management ignored the experiments. Many people came to my office and closed the door and wanted me to tell them about it, which I did. Nobody else said a thing. Wernher was very intrigued by it and was very supportive. He wanted me to do a survey of NASA installations to see if there was any place that would be useful and appropriate for us to do some more of this work to further these studies in a deeper way. But we both left NASA before we ever got that really accomplished. He also came and spoke at a fundraising dinner for the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which I didn't know that side of Wernher von Braun. He might actually be worth an episode.
I'm gonna add it right now. And also, while I'm adding that right now, no, he had nothing to do with Duna Star, so my bad. I completely retract my statement or question. I didn't make a statement. I had a question.
Next question here. When you came back, did you become a media personality because of the experiments or because you were an astronaut who had come back from the moon?
Astronaut.
Answer. A certain segment of people were truly interested in questions of mind and consciousness and spiritual matters and so forth. There were really two constituencies, like there always has been. Next question. How did your voyage to the moon change your life? Answer. After the work was done, when we were coming home, I had time to contemplate. The spacecraft was working well. I could look out the window for 3 days and enjoy it. I had a non-local feeling that there is something here I don't understand, even though I know about galactic information, how the stars and elements are formed and so on. It felt a part of it. It was my molecules. It was real, abstract sensation. That insight set the tone for my last 30 years. I had to understand, what kind of a brain is it that allows me to experience this? So I came back and started studying the mystical traditions, Uri Geller, and the inner religious experiences of humans. Because of my epiphany in space, I have come back and spent 30 years trying to explain what mind-brain is. How did you meet Uri Geller? Answer. The gentleman who was originally doing work with Dr. Andrea Puharich called me and asked if I was interested in meeting him. Geller has been investigated many times all over the world by scientists and magicians who are trying to debunk him. You have to work with these people on their terms. You find out what their shtick is, so to speak, and you set up a science protocol. That works within the parameters and that they are comfortable with. We did not set up a controlled experiment to do teleportation, for example. We didn't really know how to do that. He didn't really answer that question, did he?
Not in the least.
I guess he kind of did. He asked if you wanted to meet him, but like it kind of got just kind of ended weirdly there. But you did ask him if he could teleport a camera you forgot on the moon. Answer. That was really more of a joke because I was annoyed with him. We were trying to get work done. Okay, that's why he didn't answer it fully. Okay. We were trying to get work done in the laboratory and it wasn't working. And Geller said that he was good with teleportation. So I said, okay, teleport back the camera I left on the moon. He didn't get the camera back, but he did get two lost tie pins of mine back. A piece of one of them showed up in Geller's mouth as he was eating ice cream, to the surprise of all of us. The other tie pin and the rest of the first one then showed up in the laboratory. One piece turned up right in front of Dr. Puthoff when he was with a large group of people, and the other dropped to the floor between Dr. Puthoff and me when we were in the laboratory alone.
Both those people are in Men Who Stare at Goats. What the hell is the program called? I always call it Men Who Stare at Goats.
It's not Stargate. It's
what is
why
it?
Do we always call it Men Who Stare at Goats? We did the episode.
And they're both involved in Two of the Stars, which is where I'm getting some overlap here. I swear he came up in our Two of the Stars episode, but I couldn't search his name in there. He's definitely not in there. But I must have seen it in our research. It is, what the hell is it? I'm trying to come up with it right now before we move on because it's gonna bother the shit out of me. What was it called? This one says Project Stargate?
That's what I thought.
Is it?
Well, there's another one that I'm thinking. MK Ultra. MK Ultra.
No, it's not MK Ultra. MK Ultra.
Is that not what you're...
Oh, maybe Remote Viewing's what we're thinking of because that's the episode we did on.
Oh, potentially.
Potentially. We're both just fucking confused. Yep, we are in the Remote Viewing. Yeah, Project Stargate.
Yeah, Project Stargate. Next question in this interview. What is your most important current project? Answer. My biggest project is developing further the understanding of the quantum hologram and how it works in relation to the brain. The real enigma we don't have a handle on yet is the psychokinetic effect. It has to do with intentionality in the quantum hologram, but exactly how that functions physically is not obvious to us. The perception of non-local information like ESP is easy to explain through the quantum hologram. You're just picking up information from another person. Telepathy is just information coming in. Psychokinesis, just information going out. But the material deformation of things is a little more mysterious. It takes energy to bend a ring. We can understand healing, you are a sick person, and I give you the information and your body heals itself. But how to move a ring is a different problem. The universe and the experiences within it arise from natural causes. The remainder of the problem of consciousness, that is to look for the evidence from modern science that points the way to reality. Eventually, we'll be able to explain it all because it is natural, not supernatural. It's just our ignorance that causes it to seem unnatural. And this last question is, what is the quantum hologram? It is the concept of quantum hologram. It's based on quantum emissions from all physical objects. You, me, the camera, any physical object of macroscopic size, molecular and above, and absorbs quanta of energy. Quanta emitted from every object we've discovered carries information about the physical. The quantum hologram is this information structure from a physical object and is non-local, which means it is not space-time restricted. It appears to be a proper mechanism for explaining virtually all things, all these types of psychic manifestation that we know of. We are now beginning to understand what consciousness is, and what we understand so far is that the quantum holographic record survives. It is our history, it records our passage, it records what we do, and it's available to the future. It appears to be nature's way of preserving our experience. That's the non-local part. It's the informational part of us, so that everything we do as physical beings is recorded in the ephemeral quantum holographic record, the giant hard disk in the sky, if you will.
I can pick up what he's putting down. What I'm hearing from this is that he's pretty interested in the topic.
I especially get from the start of this that space wasn't the cataclysm that put him into it. He seemed to have a predisposition before that. Did he not? Like, he talked about being brought up religious, and there was that psychic feeling from that.
No, I totally get that it was before he went to space, which is kind of cool that his life kind of went in the path of going to space, and that I don't know that it perpetuated or whatnot with his already interest, but it definitely gave him a different perspective on where he's going. I can totally get behind what he's going. It kind of gave him a further perspective on there being more to reality, because he's seen Earth from outside, so he's seen it in a different perspective. He's seeing the tree for the tree, not for the leaves.
I do want to especially say he had to have had this interest before he went into space, because he went into space with the intention of performing a science, right, an experiment, yeah, in space. So he couldn't, right, have good realized point. This in space.
Totally good point. But it also seems like he had some very impactful moments and realizations while he was there as well. I mean, I know the point you're making that is clear is that he definitely had an interest before he went up to space, though.
I am going to turn it back just to the end of the Vice article from here. Mitchell pointed out that UFO sightings were common near military bases, but not necessarily because they were actually just experimental aircrafts or weapon tests. The alien presence was a warning. Mitchell noted that Roswell crash occurred near America's largest weapons testing range at a time when it was developing its most powerful nuclear bombs. In his view, the Roswell aliens had crashed while on important mission to prevent humans from destroying themselves in their home. Quote, "Let's hope that that is exactly what the ETs extraterrestrials are trying to show us. We don't need to be this warlike civilization. We need to learn to be a cooperative civilization working together to solve our survival problems and our sustainability problems. Because right now, civilization as we live it is not sustainable. It's a question as to whether we can make it through the century or not, the way we're doing things right now." End quote, end of article. I think actually that shows that his trip to space kind of had an impact on what he perceives of things. Like, he is talking about like sustainability.
Definitely. Yeah.
Getting along. But none of that came from his time in space. I need to make that clear. Outside of his perspective on peace and bringing everybody together. He's talking about UFOs at that point in this article.
Yeah.
But that doesn't come from his time as an astronaut. I need to make that very clear. What he's talking about there is just like he thinks they're here for peaceful purposes.
Oh, okay.
And specifically to bring everybody together and kind of give that feeling that he got in space. Which
I don't like people pushing an agenda of what aliens are really up to. I don't like that.
It very eerily sounds like somebody else who we've finished a two-part episode on fairly recently too, does it not? They're here for peace. They're all peaceful.
What's that again?
Stephen Greer.
That's why I'm saying I don't like it when they're telling me, yes, they're bad or good. And you only get the two. Nobody's kind of divided on the matter. You only get, they, and there's definite opinions.
Aliens aren't allowed to choose for themselves. We have to tell you.
not all people are inherently bad or good. I mean, some people, but most people have, you know, their good moments and their bad moments. My other question to you is, Edgar Mitchell, he's never had any experiences with UFOs.
Nope.
Just an interest. Okay.
Not at all. And it's funny because he grew up right beside Roswell. Like I said, he was a teenager when Roswell happened and was an astronaut.
That's just going to happen naturally. Yeah, that's just going to happen naturally, I think.
I think a lot of people like to assume that he has an interaction with aliens that brought him about to this, but absolutely nothing in his past.
I could see that. People like this can also play off that assumption, knowing full well that that's probably the assumption.
And this is the important thing. They can leave that part of it unstated and let everybody who's listening assume that that's where it comes from. And that works very well in this community.
100%, especially if you're talking about UFOs.
I did just want to end part one off with, this came from a book review by Bob Carroll. It's called The Entangled Minds of Dean Radin, where he's talking about the experiment that Edgar Mitchell did in space.
Okay, good.
So I just kind of want to talk about it. Somebody looking at this. And it came from the Skeptics Dictionary, skeptic.com. Original news reports made it sound like there were 200 trials, leaving one to conclude that Mitchell went through his tables 8 times. There are 25 cards in the standard Zener deck. Since there are 5 symbols of numbers in each table, chance guessing would be 1 of 5 or 20%. Mitchell reported that 2 subjects performed better than chance and 2 performed worse than chance. What a shock. This is what you would expect from chance. News reports indicate that the group got 51 correct, which would be a rate of 25.5%. Not bad for an individual guessing 200 times, but not statistically significant for a group of 4. No problem. Mitchell provided the New York Times with the number 3,000 to 1 as being the odds against giving the results he got. Maybe this is where Radin learned to use statistical odds as a substitute for evidence. Cutting through the gobbledygook, we find that 3,000 to 1 odds are derived by an afterthought analysis of the data that found the subject did not guess correctly. Parapsychologists call this psi missing. If you guess better than chance, that supports the psi hypothesis. If you don't guess better than chance, that also supports psi hypothesis. Psi works both ways, positive and negative. Rather than canceling each other out, they reinforce each other in what is called a psi differential response. What other scientific field would tolerate such nonsense? That was a critique I found of the experiment he had and how it wasn't actually a significant result in any way.
I'm still clear on his experiment, to be honest.
He was in space, he would write down random numbers between 1 and 5, and then he would assign Zener shapes to those.
Yeah, overall question is, if he was just putting it out to the ether, like, where was he going to see if anybody picked it up or not?
Before he left, he talked to the scientists who said, we have these 4 psychics who we would like to receive your calls from space.
Right. Okay. Right. Okay. Then that was just...
But they didn't know what time he was doing it. And if they did, it was off because his flight left 40 minutes later than expected. So they basically were picking something up from the ether that had happened prior, like some time prior that they couldn't have known.
It's not a very control in an control in an experiment anyhow.
And even then they picked 4 people who are predisposed to this like world. So like, why not have a control group in any way?
Yeah. Surprised it got published anyway.
I mean, I didn't find the actual paper itself. I don't know where it was published, but I do know it still does get talked about somewhat, and like the Noetic Science
that makes sense
group comes from it. Basically,
I'm sure a lot of people would just use, for the name alone, Edgar Mitchell.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, and especially it's done in space. You can have so many things that just say like, this is a variable that is, this is how the thing got gamma radiation or space radiation to become the thing, which was the psychic stuff. So that's where it all comes from. There you go. This is where I leave this part off. He's done his career being an astronaut. He's moving into noetic sciences, and we're going to see how this moves towards the UFOs.
I'm totally excited for this. That was trying to assess how I feel about this, and I'm not sure. I don't think he's an asshole yet. I'm intrigued.
Well, we'll see how we feel.
I'm intrigued at his interest in UFOs, because I have that too. Check. Number 2, he's an astronaut. I don't have that. And then he had this like life-changing experience in space. And those are the secrets.
But that's not what brought him to UFOs. I want to make that clear. I honestly think he retired and he needed a hobby.
Yeah, I could see it. I mean, if I were to just up and become an astronaut next year, I can't say that I wouldn't wouldn't take the same interest that I have today with me into being an astronaut. You know what I mean?
But let's face it, it might actually impact our ability to be astronauts.
It's true.
They have a lot of background check on us here on Journey to the Fringe on why we shouldn't be astronauts.
Anyhow, he didn't have a podcast.
It's really what's holding our generation back. And with that, I have been Taylor, here with Chelsea. We are Journey to the Fringe. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Journey to the Fringe. If you have liked what you have listened to, please like, share, subscribe, or follow, depending on what venue you are listening to us through. Also, please, if possible, leave a 5-star review, as that really helps us in the algorithms. Should you wish to interact with us, please check us out on your social media of choice. I bet you we are there. And if you really want to communicate with us and give us ideas for new episodes, or tell us that we're wrong and terrible, either way, please send us an email at journeytothefringe@gmail.com. For now, I'll see you in the next episode.